Good evening and welcome to KVC Arts, a program dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tonight, the rest of my conversation with Ernie Watts. On a recent edition of KVC Arts, we spoke about Ernie's new album, A Simple Truth, as well as his thoughts on his earliest influence, John Coltrane. Tonight, his time with the Tonight Show Band, his work with Frank Zappa, Charlie Hayden, Pat Metheny. We'll talk about and check out a bit of music from some earlier releases as well. Music and conversation with Ernie Watts, that's coming up on the second half of the program. First, though, it's KVCR's Lillian Vasquez speaking with Daniel Hines, playing the lead role of Huey Calhoun in the production of Memphis. And that's coming to Riverside soon.
When I was a young boy, my daddy sat me down. He said, son, don't you never go to the dark side of town. I'm talking downtown Memphis.
Memphis has been the winner of 12 Broadway Awards, including 4 Tony Awards. One was for Best Book of a Musical. The second one was for Best Original Score, Best Orchestrations, and Best Musical. Daniel, tell me about Huey Calhoun and his ambitions in Memphis.
Huey Calhoun is loosely based off of a real-life disc jockey from the 1950s named Dewey Phillips, who was actually the first person to play Elvis Presley on the radio. But more specifically, what Dewey did was integrate the races in a very racially tense, 1950s and the South through music and through the radio. He started playing what was then called race music, meaning that it's rhythm and blues and the kind of music that white people just didn't listen to.
See, I was lost until I found the music of my soul. The music of my soul.
He played it on the mainstream white radio station and began to integrate first Memphis, then larger parts of the South. And eventually, he and the work of Sam Phillips with Sun Records and many others began to integrate the whole music industry across the nation. Very similar to Dewey Phillips, Huey Calhoun, a fictional character that I play in the show, his biggest ambition is to kind of do just that, to share the music that, as he calls it in the show, he calls it the music of his soul, because that's what it is. If music is our humanity, what part of what makes us human, he wants to make sure that he can share his humanity with all of the people around him and eventually around the country and the globe.
It broke down all my senses and made me feel so old. And I will love it till the day I die, the music of my soul. It broke down all
ask, you were saying that it wasn't what white people were listening to, or was it what they were admitting that they liked or listening to?
All right, that's fair. Certainly, I think there was a pretty large majority that were not listening to it, but within only a few months of Dewey Phillips playing Elvis Presley and many others like him, and then B.B. King and a lot of the black artists at the time, within just a few months, he did a little social experiment that was pretty famous at the time, where he said, anyone listening to the radio station at 10 o'clock p.m., go ahead and honk your horns, your car horns.
Oh.
And at 10 o'clock that night, legend has it, as the story goes, the whole town of Memphis was just lit up with car horns going crazy, and so much so that the police had to come down to the station and ask him very politely not to do that. Then he got on the air and said, the police have come and asked, we've broken the noise ordinance by quite a bit, so if you all would please, whatever you do, just do not, absolutely do not honk your horns at 11 o'clock p.m. And at 11 o'clock p.m., you can guess what happened. Everyone honked their horns again. So I would say you're probably right there. Whether they were admitting to it or not, people were really getting down with the music that he was playing.
Much of the reviews that I read are obviously very strong in the music, but there's a lot of dancing in this as well. Is there a lot of choreography going on with some flips?
There is definitely a lot of dancing. I actually was fortunate enough to tour with Memphis the Musical last year as well. And last year I did a lot of dancing. I was in the ensemble and understudied the role of Huey that I'm portraying this year. This year, I am actually kind of grateful to say that I do not have as much dancing to do. Huey kind of cuts his own little rug, but he's not as nimble or as put together a dancer as the rest of the cast is.
Well, congratulations on being now playing the lead role as opposed to the ensemble or the understudy. That's a feather in your cap.
Well, thank you very much.
So now tell me about Daniel Hines. Did you love theater as a little kid and you loved being on stage? Or was it kind of that high school class you had to take because you needed the credits? Or what was it? When did you fall in love with theater?
Funny, my dad actually is a career military man, 26 years in the Air Force, and then after he retired, he went back in as a civil agent. You know, generally people think of that as being, you know, the strong, silent military type, but to the contrary, he actually in college majored in trumpet performance and music education. So he's always been very artistic and musically inclined. So music has always been around our house, and dad has always been kind of, he's very extroverted and he's very animated and he's always the life of the party and that kind of thing. So he's very theatrical. So I guess there's some of it that was in my blood, but the truth is I never got into it as a kid, and it wasn't until my senior year of high school that, well, there was a girl. Mm-hmm. I wanted to spend more time with her, and she was playing the lead in the musical at school that year. So I said, well, the only way for me to spend more time with her is to get into the show. So I went and I auditioned, and I played a sailor in the musical Anything Goes, where I had one line. I shouted, "Man overboard," and then proceeded to swim off the stage. That I was like, hey, you know, this is kind of fun. Pretty much from then on, I've been doing this. And, you know, I went to college, and my degree is in musical theater performance. And then after college, I've been working professionally now for about 10 years.
Okay, so the ultimate question is, did you get to know the girl?
As we grow old, will our love stay strong, or will it disappear?
You know, I will tell you, I did get to know the girl, and, you know, we dated for a couple of months, and then it went very south. So, you know, doesn't always work out.
That's okay. You did get the girl, so that's a nice ending, regardless how long it lasted. Okay, so you studied theater in college in North Carolina, right?
That is correct.
And did you think that when you were getting your degree that you would be working right away? Because pretty much you graduated and you started working, or were you going to be a theater arts teacher?
No. I did want to perform, and I was pretty sure I was going to work right away. I thought it's going to be hard, and I have no idea what I'll be doing. But I had a couple of really great opportunities to audition for some pretty awesome projects that were right out of college. And I was able to attend my graduation ceremony, but the next morning I was on a flight out to Colorado and hit my first gig there, and then went to Cincinnati for a year with a gig out there that was a really wonderful and very formative, I suppose, experience for me. And then from then on, it's been gig after gig after gig, which has been really, honestly, I've been very fortunate. Not have any lag time between jobs.
I'll say. Not many college graduates get to start their job the next day. Nice job. So tell me some of your favorite roles that you might have performed in your college productions. Or do you have some favorite roles that you've had, that you've performed?
I do have some favorite roles. You know, I will tell you, even though we haven't opened the show yet, we're still in rehearsals. Huey Calhoun is very much a favorite of mine.
A crazy little Huey heard one no one said.
Now, the show is not very old. It opened in 2010 on Broadway.
Okay.
It started previews in 2009. And I actually saw it its opening night of previews in 2009. And then that was before they moved to Broadway. And then they moved to Broadway later in 2009. I went and saw it when it opened in New York. I was living there at the time, and I was with my roommate, and he and I, we both kind of looked at each other, and I was like, I got to play that role.
Really?
So it took a while, but I got to do it. And last year when I was on the tour, I was able to go on a number of times throughout the tour because it was, it was 10 months, and you get tired, so you got to throw the understudy in every once in a while.
Thank goodness, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I had an absolute blast. And I'll tell you, not too dissimilar from Huey Calhoun, actually, is Will Parker in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of my all-time favorite roles, and I have had the opportunity to do that show 5 times in 5 different productions, and I've played Will in Missouri and in Colorado and in Florida and Indiana. So I've had a lot of fun with Will Parker. He's definitely, I think, one of my all-time faves.
So let me ask you, what skills were kind of natural for you? Were you good at acting, singing, dancing? And which ones did you have to maybe study harder or practice more to acquire the stronger skills for that?
All right. The easier question is probably, what did I have to work harder at? And that is absolutely dancing.
Okay.
I am not an excellent dancer. You know, I'm an aggressive mover, as I like to say, but I am not an excellent dancer. So that's definitely the one that I had to work at. And in college, I took a couple of dance classes, and they kicked my butt.
Okay.
they didn't kick me out. They, they needed me.
Okay.
They needed some guys in there, and,
right.
Even the playing field a little. But yeah, dancing's definitely what I've had to work hardest at.
Singing and acting came a little more naturally?
Yeah, acting kind of came a little more naturally, but it's also something that there's something that comes naturally about it where, you're just kind of recreating real-life scenarios on stage every night. But the thing that I think you have to study and train and learn is the longevity of that, to make it real every night when you're talking about 200, 300, 400 performances in a row. Doing it once is pretty easy, but you gotta get it right over and over and over again. And so that's something that I think required some study. And then singing, like I said, music was always present in the house. I didn't do a lot of singing. I was actually an instrumentalist. I played French horn in the marching band from about 6th grade all the way through high school and then into college. So I was musically minded, but I was not vocally trained. So that was something that I had to work on in college and after. You continue. You're learning every day. Which I think is a good way to be.
I agree. You're one of the actors that was able to obtain work so quickly. But tell me about maybe your worst audition, where you didn't get the part and you left thinking, I really killed that.
Okay. Oh, boy. I have got a few pretty, pretty nasty audition stories. But I will give you one of my worst auditions. Not the worst, but one of them was actually for, when I auditioned for Memphis, not for this year's tour, but for last year's tour, when I went in, I was working out of town at the time in Pennsylvania, and I drove into New York for the audition. I went into the middle of Manhattan studio where they're auditioning, and it was, 8:30 in the morning, and I was in the first group of, 10 of us to go in and audition for all the big wigs of the Networks touring company, which is the company that was producing last year's tour. I walked in. It was very early in the morning. I was choosing a very ambitious song, and it was one that they knew quite well, because it is, in fact, Memphis Lives in Me from the musical Memphis. Not necessarily the best choice. I mean, if you're going to go in and knock it out of the park, then absolutely do that. If you're going to go in and be unsure about it, don't do that. And I walked in, and I started singing my song, and I could not for the life of me figure out what I was doing, but what had happened was I had practiced it kind of a cappella by myself because I didn't have a piano.
Right.
And I had practiced it so much in the wrong key, in the wrong part of my voice, that when the pianist started playing, I was singing it incorrectly. I was singing it not in the right key. And I actually stopped the song, and I asked if I could start again, and I went over to the piano, and I said, sorry, could you just give me that note, the starting note? And he gave me the starting pitch, and then he opened with the first chord, and I started to sing and could not get the right pitch again, and I stopped a second time and asked them, would you please play that pitch for me one more time? And he played the chord up and was like, doom, 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 ding, 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 and was like pounding on my note. And I started again, and I still didn't get it right, but I was like, I will not stop three times. So I just kept going, and it took me about four measures or so, like about a line and a half into the song, before I finally found the right note. But by some stroke of luck, by the end of the song, I had somehow won them over. I don't know how I did it. It really came together by the end, but man, at the beginning, it was rough.
So maybe your worst audition, but it played out okay for you.
It did play out okay.
Okay. Any great auditions that you knew you went in, you got it, you go, I got it, that one's a no-brainer, or you just know you left feeling good after the audition?
Yeah, actually, and now this, you know, takes me a lot longer to think back to because it was much longer ago. But when I was fresh out of college, I remember going to one of my first auditions, and it ended up being the job that I mentioned. So I guess I wasn't out of college when I attended the audition. I was still in college when I attended the audition, but it was for that job in Colorado that I got right after college, which was, in fact, my first Oklahoma that I ever did. Anyway, at the audition, I went in there, and I sang my normal song, and I did my normal monologue, and they seemed to really enjoy that, and I was like, this is going well, and they had me sing a song from their season. And I sang it, and it went really well. And then they had me sing another song from their season, and I sang it, and it went really well. And then they had me sing a third song from their season. And on the third song, I remember there's a section where there's like a gospel choir that is backing up the lead vocalist. And the pianist was over there jamming out, and I got to the part where the gospel choir comes in, and the artistic director and associate director and the reader who they had present in the audition room to assist with reading lines, they all started to sing along as the backup gospel choir, and I was singing the lead vocals on it, and we were, like, just rocking out, and everybody was enjoying it. And by the time I finished, I was like, you know, I think I got that job. And I did get that job, so that was a pretty cool experience.
What a great experience it is. In 2014, you were the recipient of the Roger Studevant Award, who was a theater lover himself. What did that award mean to you?
That award was really a wonderful, wonderful thing for me. It certainly, if nothing else, was a great kind of an affirmation of what I've been doing and what I've been working toward. It's a reward that I've actually coveted for a few years now. A friend of mine was the recipient of the award back in 2010, and that was when I was first turned on to the award and started looking into it and researching it and seeing, you know, how to apply and audition for it. And when I finally received that award, honestly, it was just a really nice moment of knowing, yeah, this is what I'm doing, you know, and doing it right. You know, I'm headed in the right direction and I'm on the right path. And that can be tough in this business because you do face a lot of rejection, you know. For as much as, you know, we talked about those two audition experiences, both good and bad, but in both cases I got the job. For those two where I got the job, there have been literally hundreds where I do not get the job. And when you're living in New York and auditioning, you may be going to multiple auditions per day. So you may hit 2, 3, 4 auditions in one day, or at least 5, 6, 7 in a week for sure. Wow. And you don't get those jobs, you know, you hear no and no and no, or more often than not, you hear nothing. You just hear silence. You sit and wonder for a while, and after a few weeks go by, you go, well, I haven't heard anything, so I guess I didn't get it. And you move on to the next one. And it was just a really affirming moment, and the board, I got to meet with them. I was able to go to New York to receive that award and meet the folks behind the decision-making. And that was a really excellent experience. They were wonderful people, and they were incredibly complimentary, but also just people that I respect very much in casting and as performers and as administrative types within the business.
Very good. Have you ever stood in front of the mirror and practiced your acceptance speech for a Tony Award or any other award you're ready to say thank you for?
You know, I honestly have not. I have certainly told probably 25 or 30 people in my life, hey, you're going to be my date to the Tonys. That means I got to attend a lot of Tony Awards ceremonies so I can take everybody that I've promised over the years. But, you know, I can't say that I have ever practiced my acceptance speech.
Well, let's get you nominated first, and then you can practice your acceptance speech.
Yeah, I think that's the way that should go.
So what role do you hope to play at some point in your career? Is there a role out there or a story out there that you would like to do? Is there a monologue out there at some point in your career?
There is absolutely a dream role. And this is one where, even though I wasn't into theater, this one has been in me since I was a little kid. I remember my dad used to play the record of Andrew Lloyd Webber's The Phantom of the Opera. Uh-huh. And when I was a little kid, you know, like a tenor, I would sing Christine. So I suppose I was actually a boy soprano. Let's not get confused here. Christine is not my dream role.
Okay.
I have wanted to play the Phantom for quite some time, and that, I think, is definitely the dream. One of these days, I'm going to play the Phantom in the Phantom of the Opera.
Because of the storyline, because of the music, because of all of it? Why is that?
You know, it really is all of it. The music, I think, is beautiful, and it's a highly theatrical show. And right now, if you look on Broadway and off-Broadway and around the country, the shows that are coming through the Broadway for America series and whatnot, there's a lot of very realistic shows where they're absolutely things from real life. Memphis is a good example of that, as it is actually highlighting real life events to some extent. And in musical theater, everything is a little bit heightened because, you know, people are having a conversation and then suddenly they burst out into song or burst into dance. So it's obviously a little bit heightened, but when you're telling real stories, it's a little more grounded. With The Phantom of the Opera, it is a very heightened story. It's very theatrical, but there's something about it that has just always drawn me, and I just love it. I love the story. I love the music. I love that heightened reality. Yeah.
Yeah. For me, I'd like to play Morellis from A Chorus Line. I can't sing,
yeah.
I can't dance, but I sure love her one song in A Chorus Line.
Yeah, that's a great one. That's a great one.
Daniel Hines will play the lead role of Huey Calhoun when he comes to the Fox Performing Arts Center on February 13th and 14th. Daniel, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.
There comes a time when muddy waters run rough. There comes a point when a man has had enough. Like a friend who always stands by me.
Lillian Vasquez in conversation with Daniel Hines, performing in Memphis at the Fox in Riverside. You're listening to KVC Arts at its new weekly time slot rather than the monthly feature it started as. Up in just a few moments, Ernie Watts, his time with the Tonight Show Band, Frank Zappa, Charlie Hayden, Pat Metheny, and so much more. We'll talk about and have a bit of music from some solo releases as well. You're listening to KVC Arts, a program dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. For the second half of the program, it's saxophonist Ernie Watts. In mid-December, we heard from him about his new album, A Simple Truth, as well as his thoughts on his earliest influence, John Coltrane. Tonight, we'll hear about some of his time with Frank Zappa, Charlie Hayden, Pat Metheny, and so much more, including this band. Even if people aren't into jazz, they still would have seen you, whether or not they knew it, they would have seen you with the Tonight Show Band for some, what, 20 years or so under Doc Severinsen?
20 years, yeah.
Yeah. Now, I've never been to a Tonight Show taping. On TV, we see mainly the cutaways and returns, unless, of course, you were backing a musical guest. But if you weren't backing a musical guest, did the band still play out full tunes during the commercial breaks and all that kind of thing?
Yeah, that's when we played a lot. You know, when they had the commercial breaks, we played the whole time. And then when they came back on, then we would stop. You know, and Johnny Carson would always cut us off and do something to stop the band.
Sure.
So the little bits that you would hear would be the ends of tunes that we had been playing, you know, maybe for like the whole break, for like 5 or 10 minutes.
That would have been a treat for me. I suppose a lot of people are there for the show, but I'd be one of those nuts that was there for the band anyway.
She don't know the baby that came with her. She only be born out of she only be born out of she
didn't. Speaking of which, the nuts in the band, Clark Terry and his mumbles routine, were you ever around for that? You'd bring that back.
She ain't only people to love her. She don't fall to him. She don't bound to him. She don't love her. She don't love her. She don't love her. She don't love her. She ain't gonna hang on the hound, the hound, the evil little level to go. She ain't gonna guard the evil little level to fill the evil five number. She really won't divide when she people see the little level to go on the go on the level. She ain't gonna hold on the level. Woo!
Seems like it would be hard to keep a straight face with something like that going on. Did he ever have the whole band cracking up where everybody just really had to take two?
Well, sure, that happens. I mean, everybody's laughing, but it never, you know, we never had to stop and go again.
Okay.
He was very, very hilarious with that.
Oh, my gosh.
But you squeal the hong, the hingest clown, the horn, the bell. But seriously, if it's cool to hang with the feather claw, and it's fun to scorn the hingle the howl, it is clean the horn, but the scattered horn, but the skingle horn it all, for the school the gong the hang it down for Watergate.
I would also swear that as a youngster, I guess, going into my teenage years, I suppose I remember Buddy Rich sitting in with the band every so often. So how many years between the Tonight Show Band and going back to when you were with Buddy Rich's band, how many years prior was that? What, the mid-late 60s, I think?
I was with Buddy Rich in 1966 and 67. I moved to L.A. in 1968. Then I started doing the Tonight Show when they used to come from New York to L.A. for like 2 or 3 weeks at a time. They make special trips to L.A. Then they moved to L.A. permanently in 1971, and I was with the band that 20 years from 1971 to 1991. And I think Buddy was probably on that show, oh boy, dozen times. Where we say he was small, but he was wiry.
Oh my God. I've heard some bootleg tapes of him chewing out people for not shaving and threatening use his black belts and all this. Oh my gosh. He was wiry. That's very politely put there, Ernie. So going back a bunch of years then, when you got your so-called temporary gig to sit in with Rich's big band, wasn't it one of your professors at Berkeley that recommended you for this one?
Yeah, Phil Wilson. I think he's still there. I'm not sure. He's a trombone player, great trombone player and arranger. he had been with Woody Herman's band.
Oh, nice.
He had gone to Berkeley to teach, and I was in one of his bands at Berkeley. And so when Buddy's band was at a place called Lenny's on the Turnpike in Boston,
okay,
he had a great alto player with him named Gene Quill. Gene Quill decided to quit and go back to New York because they were in Boston, so he just wanted to go back to New York, so he quit. And Buddy's road manager called Berkeley, called Phil Wilson to see who they would recommend to go out on the road with Buddy for a couple of weeks till they got to New York, you know, and then they would get a real musician. So I left the school and joined Buddy's band, and then I was with Buddy for like 2 years, and we traveled the world, you know, and I did 3 or 4 records with Buddy. I guess I got the job.
Yeah, that was your temporary gig.
Yeah, that was my temporary gig.
Yeah. Another world tour was with Oliver Nelson's band, I was reading very recently, and with the tour to Africa, you said that you were sitting in with some of the local musicians of the various countries, but you found it to be, you said, a timeless band. Please expand on this statement.
Well, Africa is a timeless place. You know, it was just such an amazing place to be. And the musicians and what they were playing was their classical music. You know, it was their music that they had been playing for centuries. You know, different things, different feels, different music that they played that was tribal. And the families passed the music down. You know, the families were like music guilds. And if you were born into a music family, you played an instrument. So that's how this music moved through the ages, you know, being passed from father to son, father to son. So, you know, it was very, very ancient music and very, very strong music. So it was quite an experience, you know, walking around and going to the marketplace and going to the river and seeing hippos swimming around and all kinds of different things.
You don't get that in L.A. Yeah.
No, you don't get hippos in the river in L.A.
You barely have a river anymore. With Charlie Hayden, it was a performance at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in L.A., right? Didn't he make his way backstage to introduce himself to you after a performance?
Yeah, there was a piece that was written for me by a great French composer, Michel Colombier, and it was a concerto for saxophone and orchestra, and I performed that at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion in L.A., and Charlie came to the concert and came backstage after the concert and introduced himself, and we met and we talked, and he was interested in doing some playing, so I said, wow, that would be great. So from that point, I started playing with Charlie.
And was that with his Liberation Music Orchestra?
Yeah, I played maybe 2 or 3 concerts with the Liberation Orchestra because he was setting up like a West Coast version of that. And then what we did was we went out and did some special concerts with Pat Metheny, a special quartet. And it was Pat and Charlie and Harvey Mason and myself. And we went to Brazil. We were in Brazil for a while and around South America. And then we did another tour of Japan. It was called Live Under the Sky. And it was a tour with Pat's band and Miles' band and Sun Ra.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
So, you know, I'd see all those guys every day for a while, too.
Oh, my
and
gosh.
And then the Quartet West was created.
That was over a couple of decades, anyway?
That was 25 years.
Now, it's also stated, this is also just right there at your website, erniewatts.com, your touring with Metheny's group in the late 80s was said to be a turning point for you. And again, this is a quote, the serious energy of Pat's music just inspired you to work at this level of performance. And more notably, I suppose, every night you say you listened to and rejoiced in the power you were feeling in the music. What was it that felt different with Pat?
Well, the thing is, I had been in the studios for 25 years. I had played on hundreds of R&B records. I did all of Barry White stuff. I did all of the Motown stuff. You know, all of the things with the Commodores. I did all of the things with Earth, Wind, and Fire. I was in horn sections. I was playing on records. I was playing on pop records and doing commercial TV for 25 years, you know, and practicing and studying at home and listening to Coltrane and playing with my own group on weekends. But when I got to play with Pat, you know, it was the first time that I'd worked continuously with a person and with a group that was totally focused on their stuff. Up until that point, I had been doing other things and this, that, and the other, and playing my music on the weekend. And it's a different kind of energy. So that's what I'm talking about when I talk about the energy.
Gotcha.
I'm talking about somebody that's totally committed to doing their music, and they go out and they do that every day. They don't play on somebody's record. They don't play on somebody's TV show.
Gotcha.
They're doing their music. And when somebody does their music, it creates a particular kind of energy, just like Miles, just like Train, just like Monk. All of these people, they did their music, and because they focused on what they did, it created a very focused kind of energy. And that's what I felt, and that's what I really wanted to do, because that's what I had wanted to do from the beginning, you know, from the first time I heard Coltrane on Kinda Blue. That was what I wanted to do. So it gave me the opportunity to experience that kind of energy on a daily basis, playing with Pat and then with Charlie for all those years. So now that's what I do.
Almost a return, I suppose. With the Liberation Music Orchestra, you were playing songs of, say, the Spanish Civil War, for example. Hayden,
right,
at this point, reveling in music that made statements on liberating social change. So how was this represented in what you were playing? If not through, we were talking about this earlier, the vocals telling the story for you, what was going on with this music if it was instrumental stuff?
Well, there was still a commitment to something that was intense. You know, it was a commitment to something having to do with freedom or something having to do with harmony, with peace, you know. So there was a purpose to it. It wasn't just playing something that everybody's going to like and they can tap their feet and they can jump up and down and drink wine.
Yeah.
You know, it was music with a purpose other than the basic purpose that most people think music is for.
If this comes through to the player, then the player will bring it out to the audience. They will
That's
feel
right.
it as well. All right.
That's right. So it creates a different feeling.
Nice. Talk about Frank Zappa for just a bit. The Grand Wazoo, this album from, I suppose, 72 or 3 or so. Your part in this is much as a character in a play, if a person reads the story that accompanies the album.
It was a story. It was supposed to be a story.
And you're really only credited on one of the tunes. Were you really a part of the larger ensemble, only stepping forward for a bit of this musical conversation with...
I played a lot with Frank. I was not a member of the Mothers. I did not go on the road with Frank because at the time I was so busy I couldn't afford to go on the road with Frank. I would have loved to, but it didn't make economical sense. It didn't pay well.
Very correct.
It was great music. And if I wasn't busy, I would have gone in a heartbeat. You know, I would have gone to be a part of that music. But at the same time, you know, I was doing The Tonight Show, I was doing all of these other things, and I couldn't afford to do it in that way. So I did some recordings with Frank. you know, Frank did the very first album that Jean-Luc Ponty did in the United States, which was called King Kong.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And I played on that, and I think George Duke is on that, and John Guerin. We did a bunch of jazz recording with George, and I don't know what happened to those things, but there's some of those things around. And then we did some big orchestral things with Zubin Mehta and the Los Angeles Philharmonic, Frank's music for orchestra. And it was quite difficult. It was really great music. He was sort of like a Varese or an Alban Berg or one of the contemporary classical composers that wrote classical music, and then he had a rock and roll rhythm section on it. You know, but all of the things he was doing as far as orchestral tools were from contemporary classical music. You know, you can hear Stravinsky in there. You can hear a lot of those things intervallically.
People talk about that, specifically Stravinsky's Firebird Suite and comparing that to the Waka to Waka and Grand Wazoo stuff.
That's right.
And did you not just go to Chicago? This may be a couple of years by now, but didn't you lead some Zappa material with Chicago Symphony?
Yeah, I've done like two or three Zappa tributes. They're always a lot of fun.
You mentioned George Duke. He was also one of the Grand Wazoo players, and
That's right. Oh gosh,
unfortunately, we just lost him. But also, right here, still in this area, Don Preston. I also mentioned Sal Marquez. Uh-huh. You mentioned working with Jean-Luc Ponty and George Duke. Any other Zappa alum in non-Zappa settings, I should say? That's a big,
Ian
big question.
Ian Underwood. I used to work a lot with Ian and Ruth.
Oh, really, Underwood?
Yeah.
Nice. What were those settings?
We did films. Ian did a lot of studio work after Frank, because he was one of the pioneers in the synthesizer technique. And in the early 80s, the synthesizer was totally adopted by the studio business. And so there was a lot of synthesizer in films and TV and pop music. So I'd see Ian a lot because he created a lot of those sounds.
I only knew him through the old, the Hot Rats or whichever old Frank Zappa albums.
Sure.
Going back to one of your albums, Classic Moods, at a glance, easily a safe buy for someone wanting the familiar. Quite a few straight-ahead standards here, along with a couple of yours, kicking off with In a Sentimental Mood. So was it, again, you doing the sequencing here, knowing that this would set the tone for the album?
Yeah, you know, that was a JVC project. And the producer on that was Akira Taguchi. And we wanted to do an album of ballads. So that was the concept for that particular project. And In a Sentimental Mood is sort of the feeling of that.
Thank you.
classic moods. One of the tunes on here that is one of yours, Blues Now and Then, it's not a down and dreary blues piece. It kicks off with a really bouncy, for lack of a better word, bass line. The lead-in on that, was that written out, or did you just have him kick it off to drive the song and that's what we got?
Yeah, that was improvised.
Okay, okay. And that's one that I really have to go back to every time because I go back to this album for the ballads, the more relaxing pieces, but then I get picked right back up with Blues Now and Then. To the point, this is a great live disc, which makes me want to ask, what goes into a live set for you? I think maybe the live discs may be more of a high energy, less sequencing, just playing for the crowd. Tell me the difference between when you go out to play live versus when you're thinking about something for the studio.
I think when we play live, you know, we play a little longer. We all play a little freer. I think when you record in the studio, you always play a little different because in the back of your mind, it's like, well, whatever I do here, it's going to be there forever and ever. And so I believe that most musicians get a little more careful when they record in the studio. And when you play live, you're a little more open and not as confined, especially if you know you're not recording. Nowadays, every time you pick up your instrument, you're recording. You know, you go to a concert, you play your instrument, and then people are recording every note you play on their phone. So, I mean, every time I play my instrument, it's a recording.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
So you get used to that, you know. But, I mean, it used to be that when you went in the studio or if you knew you were recording, you kind of thought a little bit different about what you played because you knew it was going to be there forever. So sometimes you were a little more careful, and sometimes you were a little too careful. I think people like Coltrane and Miles that recorded a lot, they finally got to the point where they weren't inhibited by it. They didn't think about it too much. But you have to be in the studio a lot. You have to record a lot before you get to the point of not thinking about it.
It'd be hard to let that go.
Yeah, it is. You know, because when you record something, it's there forever. So you don't want to goof up.
Yeah.
So if you don't want to goof up, then you kind of edit yourself. And so sometimes you don't play as freely as you would play live.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ernie. That's saxophonist Ernie Watts, and it's simply erniewatts.com to stay on top of his performance schedule, keeping in mind that he spends about half his time in Europe and half his time in Southern California, but you could easily find him playing not too far away in the not too distant future. And that's just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Ernie Watts as well as Nancy Meyer. She represents Ernie and got me in touch with him and quite a few others, really. Thanks again, Nancy. A big thanks again to Daniel Hines, performing as Huey Calhoun in the production of Memphis, coming to Riverside at the Fox February 13th and 14th. Here at KVCR, thanks to Donald Taylor, Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Lindsay Weisgarber, Emmanuel Rogers, Sean Houlihan, and General Manager Alfredo Cruz. Music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts. Behind us now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear any and all KVC Arts programs via podcast at kvcr.org. Tonight's show may take a few days to get in. KVC Arts, having started off as a monthly feature, is now a weekly show. Listen Wednesday nights at 7 with a repeat airing Sunday evenings at 6. Thanks to everyone involved in getting it to this point, namely, though, again, Rick Dulock and Lillian Vasquez. And David Fleming, thanks especially to you for listening and for your support.